May it please the court. My name is Edmund Chang and I represent the United States. The court below clearly erred by finding that the defendant had met his burden to show a Batson violation. In essence, what the district court did was find not credible a reason that the government had not offered for the peremptories. What happened here was that the district court mistakenly believed the government had claimed that the lack of college education and the lack of white-collar experience would be automatic disqualifiers in the government's approach to jury selection. And once the district court had that mistaken premise in its mind, the rest of its analysis was doomed to be fatally flawed. The record supports only one conclusion in this case, and that there was no race discrimination in the exercise of the peremptories. Now, it's true that the government did state to the district court that it would consider generally as positives in selecting jurors college education and white-collar experience. But saying that does not equal what the district court mistakenly believed the government had claimed, which is that they would be automatic disqualifiers in the government's approach to jury selection.
I must say that I really, Mr. Chang, don't find that to be a fair reading of the district court's decision. The district court didn't operate from an assumption that, you know, those factors were automatically disqualifying. And the second factor, the juror's ability to understand the government's case, which was one of the two factors that the government considered to be particularly significant, the other being the juror's work experience. The second factor wasn't limited to education. The court described answers to verbal and written questions as some of the factors reflecting the juror's ability to understand the case. And Judge Cannelli later referred to those factors as key criteria, which seems to be really an accurate characterization of the government's position. But the court didn't speak of them in terms of automatic disqualification.
Well, Judge, I think it's true that the court used the term key criteria in describing what the government had claimed in the briefs below. But what the district court actually did was to treat the government's claim as if we had claimed it was automatic criteria. And we know that because if you look beyond just what the court said in generally describing our description of our reasons for the strikes, the court then deemed as irrelevant evidence that traditionally in evaluating a Batson challenge would be evidence of non-discrimination. And let me give you an example. The government did not exercise all of its peremptory challenges, right? We had seven. We exercised five initially. We had two left over. We could have, but did not, exercise those two leftover strikes against minority jurors. Now, that ought to be, in the traditional Batson analysis, powerful evidence of non-discrimination. But what the district court said was, well, that argument misses the mark. In other words, that evidence is irrelevant because you government said that there was these criteria, stated criteria for exclusion. So when the district court proceeded with its analysis, it didn't treat the government's claim as key criteria, but rather automatic disqualifiers. It was a litmus test, Your Honor, and I think that's just one example where the district court deemed what would normally be evidence of non-discrimination as irrelevant, and indeed, the district court turned that on its head, that evidence of non-discrimination. The court said, well, you didn't exercise all of your strikes, and because you didn't exercise all of the strikes, well, you weren't applying your stated criteria for exclusion. Now, that only makes sense if the district court is treating the government's claim as that we had a litmus automatic criteria for exclusion. And we never said that. We offered, for example, in the briefing below, we told the court that there were positive characteristics of jurors that we did not strike.
Well, was it 11 who was the boiler inspector?
He worked for NICOR, yes, Your Honor, juror 11.
So You describe him as someone engaged in something akin to law enforcement, but he's someone who goes into people's homes and, what, is he the meter reader or what?
No, Your Honor, I think what we can get, what the record shows, is that he investigated accidents on behalf of NICORP. And in particular,
He investigates accidents. It wasn't just a one-time event. I thought he just happened to be in some place when there was an accident. I didn't know he was an investigator.
Judge Posner, it's not perfectly clear because of how limited the voir dire was, whether his job at NICOR was an ongoing investigation job. But he was assigned by NICOR to investigate this claim that some customers had made that NICOR was responsible for a mercury leak. Okay, so what we were simply saying to the district court was that here is an individual, Juror 11, who worked on behalf of a company and investigated a claim that turned out to be a fraudulent claim against the company. Right? And the prosecution, of course, was a case in which the employee, the defendant, that was an employee of a corporation, and the charges were that he had defrauded the company. And so I think the prosecutors very reasonably believe that that experience, and in a very well-publicized fraud case, his experience in defending the company was a positive characteristic. And that's not all that...
Now, he had a nephew and a niece who were or had been in the sheriff's office in Kane County. Is that right? Did he have military service?
He did as well. He was in the Army for 2 years in the 1950s. He also had, it's not clear if it was just two, but he had several Kane County sheriff's deputies who were relatives of his. And I think what is very important about what Juror 11 said during the voir dire was that he was impressed by his nephew's work in law enforcement. So he had a positive impression.
But now 27, didn't 27 also have some... Was that the juror who gave this kind of garbled explanation about he wanted to be in...
Your Honor, I believe you're talking about Juror 36.
36?
Is the one who had previously worked for the Chicago Police Department as a typist.
Okay, and typist, then, so the, right, that's what
right. And the judge asked during voir dire, well, have you had any other job with law enforcement that you've applied for other than your job with the police department, which... in our view, is a very straightforward question. And the answer was no, maybe the sheriff. And, you know, the judge apparently was confused because he tried to follow up and he said, you may have applied for a job with the sheriff? And she said, I would like to. That showed, you know, clearly some confusion as to what the judge was asking, which was simply, have you applied for another law enforcement job? And she was answering a different question. I'd like to apply for another law enforcement job. Now, Judge Connelly then characterized this, and this is in the second half of his opinion, really. He characterized that as, well, a momentary confusion, and I had thrown her a hard slider, in the judge's words, by asking this question. I still don't see what the difficulty is in understanding that question. But even taking it on its own terms, what the district court failed to do then in analyzing Juror 36 is to then deal with the other reasons that the government had offered. So, for example, the government had also alerted the district court to our concern that the next answer by Juror 36 was just as confusing. In following up, Judge Connelly asked, so you would like to, in a similar capacity, the same type of job you had with the police department? Okay, that's a typist job. And her answer was, I would like to be an officer. I would type for the police. As we stand here today, we don't know what that means. And, you know, the judge basically gave up during voir dire at that point, trying to make sense of the answers. And so the district court's analysis of Juror 36 omitted any discussion of this next answer, which, you know, as I said, as we stand here today, we don't know what she meant by that.
See, it seems to me that you have just a very difficult burden here, because the district court's decision can't be reversed unless we find that, you know, it's clear error. I mean, that's the standard of review that ultimately would be dispositive here. And, you know, you have this very fine brief which asks us, you know, to do this extensive reweighing of the evidence as to each of the potential jurors and, you know, asking us to basically draw completely different conclusions as to whether reasons that were given were actual, pretextual. But that really isn't our role here. Well, I mean, you know, the district court's conclusions have support in the record, and...
Your Honor, here, we've overcome the clear error standard of review, and I understand what it is. And what it is that upon a review of the entire evidence in the record, if you come to a firm and definite conviction that the district court got it wrong, and what I submit to you is that a review of the entire evidence in the record shows firmly and definitely that the district court got it wrong. And when you, Your Honor, asks about reweighing of the evidence, that's the district judge did not weigh most of the evidence. I mean, there's in the first part of its analysis, which didn't talk about any one specific juror. Okay, this is the second half talked about jurors 9, 21, and 36. The first part, the judge refused to consider, for example, that we had remaining strikes that we didn't use against minority jurors, that other jurors had positive.
That's in the past has been a significant aspect of in Batson cases.
Absolutely, absolutely, Your Honor. It's I think it's a required part of a Batson analysis to actually evaluate the circumstances that the government and the evidence.
So Judge Cannelli, so it was 9, 21, and 36. Now, in comparison, was 11? Was the boiler fellow? Was that the only comparison he used, or were there other whites that he thought?
In the district court's opinion, first, the district court refused to consider the positive characteristics of juror 11 when comparing them.
I'm just trying to get straight. So three he thought were struck improperly, 9, 21, 36, but he bases that in part at least on a comparison with whites who he thought were no more promising from a government standpoint. Was 11 the only one he compared, or were there others whom you did not object to who he thought had the same characteristics, you know, other than ethnicity or race, as 9, 21, and 36?
That's the only one he mentioned, Judge.
That's the only one he mentioned.
And at the risk of running into my rebuttal time further, let me just say, when you say compared, he didn't actually compare. The district court did not actually compare the positive characteristics or consider the positive characteristics of Juror 11.
Did he mention the military service and the police? Well, I think the military service is pretty peripheral. It was so long ago. But the relatives and the sheriff's department?
Your Honor, he not only did not consider it, but the district court said that misses the mark. Okay, that evidence is irrelevant because... government, you had remaining strikes. And so if you were applying your stated criteria for exclusion, which I think as applied is only means automatic criteria for exclusion, you didn't have to choose between these jurors. You should have struck one of them. You should have struck 9, 21, or 11, but you didn't. And therefore, I find your stated criteria for exclusion.
But doesn't it come down to that he thought your failure to strike 11 was the critical. Is that the critical? Is that what his conclusion really turns on? You had a peremptory challenge. You could have gotten rid of 11, who's not white collar and so on. Is that it? Or are there other people he thought you should have? So you had two peremptory challenges. Was there someone else he thought you should have struck?
Right. What happened was we first exercised five out of our seven. There was an overlapping strike. And Judge Cannelli gave the government one more, so we exercised one more at that point. But our initial round, we did not exercise two of them. And so, yes, the district court then, the only juror that the district court started to consider but ultimately did not as comparators was juror 11. And that's it. And again, Your Honor, it, in the opinion, the district court did not then consider the positive characteristics. That's irrelevant. That's irrelevant because you had criteria for exclusion and you didn't apply them. We had never said so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chang. Ms. Dmitrieva?
Your Honors, may it please the Court. Let me just address what I've heard from the counsel. Now, I don't want this Court to be left with an incorrect impression that this entire, you know, Mr. Stevens' entire Batson claim, you know, turns on juror number 11. Let's not forget that what this particular court found impressive in its first decision in this case, when we discussed the prima facie stage of the Batson inquiry, that the government used 100% of its strikes on minority members of the Van Eyre. The government...
Members being grouped as regardless of whether they're Asian or African-Americans.
Minority members...
Or Hispanics.
Yes.
Because they're the same...
The government struck two African-Americans, three Hispanic-Americans.
Why would you expect the government to... I understand why they might want to strike a black juror, but why would they want to strike a Hispanic? Is there some literature that suggests solidarity between Hispanics and blacks?
So well, as this court actually noted in its first opinion in this case, that the use of strikes to, you know, to exclude minority members, they wanted... perhaps to stack the jury with just, you know, white Caucasian members.
The question is, what is the motive? You wouldn't suppose that some person was Chinese or Indian or something. You wouldn't expect the government, however malevolent, to say, well, we don't want non-Cook, actually Indians are Caucasian, but we don't want people who are not, you know, very white, very pale. On a jury, it makes sense, right?
Well, it does make sense to me, and apparently it did make sense to Judge Cannelli that it is possible.
Why strike Asians, for example? It's not that Asians are considered to be, you know, maybe not law-abiding or something, or they've had a lot of bad experiences with the police. And I mean, that's one of the problems with blacks. They tend to have bad experience with police, so they're hostile and suspicious. But you don't have that with... You have that with... I mean, is that the problem, that Hispanics are believed to be hostile to the police or hostile to law enforcement?
It is conceivable that the government thought that, you know, members of minorities, including Hispanics, who perhaps had some...
All minorities, you're treating all minorities fungibly, as if all minorities are hostile to prosecution. Is there some literature that discusses this issue?
Well, with all respect, I mean, that's not my approach, but we believe that, you know, the government could have thought that Hispanics, you know, and African Americans and Asian could have been less pro-government than white Caucasians, that white males. And there were, as Judge Cannelli noted, there were five white males who didn't have either white collar experience, you know, or a college education that the government chose to leave on the jury.
But surely the government, in its thinking about these things, even assuming they just want to win, they don't really care about the qualities of the juror, but surely they're going to consider more than a person's education. Suppose they found someone who they thought was not an educated person, but he was a person who would always vote to convict. He loved the police. He loved the prosecutor. They would love to have a person like that on the jury, even if they thought he couldn't really understand what was going on, right?
Well, Your Honor, I see a fundamental flaw in the discussion we engage right now, because, you know, the United States Supreme Court made clear that, you know, the Batson inquiry, the third step, does not amount to thinking up any rational basis the government, you know, could have had for exercising
notes,
the strikes.
Don't we have the notes that they made?
Those notes, you know, I reviewed them extensively, and those notes are not as straightforward.
Did the judge discuss the notes?
The, you, you know, in, The parties briefed these issues extensively, and the argument that the government is presenting to this court is the very same argument that the government presented to Judge Connelly. You know, we certainly discussed all of the evidence, including the prosecutor's notes, in all of the briefs. And Judge Connelly, in rendering his decision, stated that he doesn't find the government's explanation credible based on all of the evidence in the record after assessing all of the evidence.
But did he discuss, for example, the fact that Juror 11 had these relatives in the sheriff's office in Kane County?
I believe Judge Connelly didn't believe it was necessary because the very proffered reasons that the government itself proffered as key justifications for striking these jurors, Judge Connelly didn't find them credible.
Could I just interject something? It seems to me that Judge Connelly was clearly aware of the notes. He mentioned them in his decision. So, you know, I don't think there'd be a reason to believe that he disregarded them, do you?
I think there is no basis to claim whatsoever that Judge Connelly somehow refused to consider the evidence. There is nothing in his opinion.
And with your last point, don't you think that the prosecutors are looking for people who seem to be well-disposed toward government, toward police? Doesn't it make sense they'd be looking for people like that? And they'd trade that off against lack of education?
Yes, I believe they may have been looking for those people. Unfortunately, you know, they probably believed that white, you know, people would be more pro-government than you know, members of minorities.
Well, there are Hispanic or black people here whom they struck who have relatives in the police department.
Yes, juror number 21, Hispanic, you know, well, it's not police, but his close relative was serving in the army and was serving in Iraq, and somehow that factor, the government didn't consider that factor to be positive. And the problem that you know, I see with the government's argument is that not a single reason that they give, they apply consistently across the board. It seems like, you know, for instance, the law enforcement reason, and yet they disregard this reason, you know, with respect to Hispanic juror number 21. They say that, you know, minority juror had a relative who was under home arrest, was important to them, but yet they disregard the very significant criminal record of two white jurors whose close relatives were, you know, drug felons who served 5 to 6 years in jail. So not a single reason is applied consistently, and that was what the district court's, you know, task was at the first stage, to assess how probable or improbable, based on all the evidence, the prosecutor's explanations are.
Is this the kind of case that engenders that sort of gut reaction among jurors?
Could you please repeat the question?
Well, you have a Yale-educated, was he? Didn't graduate.
Yes.
In a white-collar situation where he defrauded a large company, is that cause a lot of emotional aspect with regard to how the
Well, yes, I believe it does, because he would be like the only African-American person in the courtroom because all of the witnesses against him were
Did
white.
Did he hurt anybody?
Sorry?
Did he injure anyone?
Well, he injured the corporation, allegedly.
Do you see a difference maybe between that and a armed robbery case or a drug case or cases in which physical violence was involved?
Well, I believe this issue was addressed, you know, in the first opinion in this case that, no, I do not see the principal difference, you know, in these situations. You know, there may be a difference of degree, but not in principle. And because all the witnesses would be white, and the issue presented would be the credibility of his testimony regarding his intent and motivation. So it would be the word of an African-American defendant versus circumstantial evidence presented by white witnesses. And you know, I believe the most important, you know, point to make, you know, in my speech here is that the standard of review here is clearly erroneous. And under the standard of review, it's indisputable. It applies, you know, both in situations in which there is a live testimony or in a situation in which the judge makes his fact findings based on purely documentary and physical, you know, evidence. Moreover, you know, the decision regarding racial, you know, presence of racial discrimination is a credibility determination that is entitled to even greater deference. And under the clearly erroneous standard of review, the role of this court is not to second-guess the trial judge, even if this court believes that were it sitting, you know, in place of Judge Connelly, it would have decided this case differently. That's not the standard. That's not the reason to reverse him.
Isn't Juror 11 really, really quite critical to your argument?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit to you that there are more than just Juror 11
but
who are comparable.
It's all that Judge Connelly discussed, isn't it?
He discussed. The reason, you know, Juror number 11 is important is because we matched this juror by four factors, by four characteristics that government identified as allegedly important to them, you know, in striking the minority jurors. You know, I submit to you that there are more jurors than just Juror 11 who are comparable, because there were five, you know, jurors, like in
the
both.
Judge didn't discuss the others. He just discussed 11.
Well, this is the juror whom we matched by four characteristics, and under the Supreme Court decision in Miller L., we didn't even have to do that. In Miller L., the Supreme Court said there is no requirement for defendant to find an absolutely identical, similarly situated jurors, because jurors are not product of cookie cutters.
If you find a jurist, if there's a white person who clearly, from the government standpoint, is more attractive than the one they struck, well, that destroys the case, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. Judge Connelly also found that the government may have discriminated against some and perhaps all of the jurors. In my opinion, and I'm not quite sure why Judge Connelly didn't address that, but juror number 27, for instance.
Yeah, I understand. You make the 20 argument 27, but what's odd, though, is that what are you asking us to do with respect to 27? Are you asked us to find that was discriminatory too, even though Judge Connelly didn't find that?
Well, all I'm asking this court to do is to uphold the Judge Connelly's ruling, because it's not clearly
wrong. How can we use 27?
Based on the entire evidence in this case, and this entire evidence includes the pattern of government strikes against every single one of the six minority jurors.
Why didn't he mention 27?
Because he found it sufficient on the record in its entirety that the government did discriminate against those three jurors. He didn't have to go further. He did not find government's explanations as to jurors 9, 21, and 36 credible. And it was his province to assess the credibility of the government. And, you know, I wasn't at the trial. Your Honors weren't at the trial. Judge Connelly was presiding at the jury selection proceedings.
Yeah, but he didn't think about it until 2.5 months after the sentence. Right?
He obviously did thought about it at the time of jury selection, but didn't find it appropriate to raise it at that time. And he did raise it sua sponte, 2.5 months after trial. You know, he made it clear in his initial, you know, request for government to explain its reasons that he did notice that potential problem at the time of jury selection.
The fact that the lawyer didn't raise it.
That the lawyer representing Stevens? I cannot speak to his trial strategy. I
mean, that's correct, isn't it, that Stevens' lawyer did not raise a Batson issue during the jury selection?
Not.
Doesn't that suggest that he didn't notice anything amiss?
No, it doesn't suggest anything to me.
Pardon?
It doesn't suggest anything. I cannot speak to the trial strategy of the trial counsel for Mr. Stevens. What I know is that for now we're assessing whether Judge Connelly's view of credibility of the government is clearly erroneous. And to me, what Mr. Stevens' trial counsel, what was his trial strategy, is not relevant to the inquiry whether Judge Connelly's assessment of prosecutor's credibility is clearly erroneous in this case. And there is... In a clear way, all this court has to find it is that Judge Connelly's view of the evidence is plausible based on all the evidence. And to me, it's more than plausible. To me, to suggest that there have been some other explanation to strike, you know, to exercise six out of seven strikes, to strike, you know, minority with every single strike, that would be implausible.
Was the lawyer asked why he hadn't raised a Batson issue?
Well, I mean, as you're aware, I mean, there was no live evidentiary hearing which the government opposed, and so no, the lawyer was not asked. To my knowledge, I haven't seen in the record, you know, any explanation as to why he didn't raise that objection.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, I believe, 1 minute left. And I believe Judge Connelly certainly applied the right methodology to his findings. He was very aware of the law. He considered, he didn't consider just the two characteristics, you know, the college education and white collar experience. As to three jurors, he reviewed the evidence and he employed his own observation of the proceedings. For instance, to juror 36, he said, "I recall what was going on in the courtroom. I recall, you know, the reaction of the jurors." And in his unique situation of being able to you know, employ his recollection of the proceedings, he decided that the government's explanations were not credible. And certainly as to juror number 27, you know, when the government rated this black woman B-, and it rated two other white male jurors B-, who, you know, didn't have a white collar experience, who didn't have education, it shows to me there was no principal difference among those jurors. You know, that's an additional evidence. And they accepted, you know, two white males, and they struck the black female.
If the judge had said that that there's nothing in the notes to indicate that the prosecutors cared anything about, say, number 11's boiler inspection experience, or his relatives in the Kane County Sheriff's Office, that would be very powerful for your case. But the judge didn't say that. He didn't talk about
that. It doesn't mean he didn't consider it. To me, it doesn't mean he didn't consider it. You know, there may be some evidence that was, you know, more important to him than other evidence, but to make this inference that just because he didn't mention it, in the beginning he said, after assessing all of the evidence, government admits, and they cannot say otherwise, that these issues were extensively briefed. All of the evidence was brought in front of the district judge. And to make an argument that somehow he didn't consider it, when the judge explicitly said, yes, I considered all of the evidence, which included the government's notes, you know, discussing extensively the law enforcement connections, you know, juror number 11, to me that's just not fair. It's not fair reading of Judge Connelly's opinion. I see.
Okay,
my concern.
Well, thank you, Ms. Dmitrieva. Mr. Chang? Yeah, you can have time. So what do the notes show about...
What, juror 11, Your Honor?
About 11, yeah.
So in juror 11, which is... it shows, it corroborates what the prosecutors took into account with regard to juror 11. First, one of the prosecutors circled Army. Okay, that's the military experience. In addition, one of the prosecutors wrote nephew, niece, Kane County Sheriff Department. And then later on, because tracking juror 11's response to Judge Connelly's question, so you know, will that influence you in any way? Law enforcement experience of his relatives. He said, "I'm impressed." And so the juror wrote, "I'm sorry."
But is there anything about the boiler?
No, but that is he wrote that the juror questionnaire reflects in the juror's own handwriting that he worked for NICOR, and there are notations by the prosecutor that. Under the question, have you or any relatives or close friends ever been a witness to the crime? Prosecutor wrote, utility accidents, investigator, underline. Okay, and so...
Well, the prosecutor... So that's contemporaneous with...
With jury selection, Your Honor.
That was during the voir dire or before when he looked at the questionnaire or what?
No, it was during the voir dire.
He wrote that. Okay.
Right, it had to come out during the voir dire. And it, like I said, it tracks the voir dire... the actual in-court voir dire. And if I can make one other point,
yeah, sure.
On the notes, I know I'm over my time, but the notes were mentioned, Judge Rovner, in the district court opinion, but in a footnote in the beginning where the judge was simply describing, here's all of the massive record that has been compiled, and that's why no evidentiary hearing is required. And
in the absence of a Batson challenge, how long do prosecutors keep their notes of jury selection?
Your Honor, there isn't obviously a specific you know,
well,
reference
I know,
in the record,
general.
but you know, generally, my guess is that most prosecutors have different practices on it. I'd be hard pressed
to find. But there'd be no reason to keep them other than just the fact that I always keep my notes from trial or whatever.
That's right, Your Honor. There wouldn't be. If there's no issue has come up, either Batson or some other, you know, jury issue post-conviction, there wouldn't be a reason to keep them. And so I just wanted to emphasize that what the district court did in just mentioning the notes was not saying that I've considered the notes. And there is no mention of the notes in its analysis. And so all there was you know, there's no need for an evidentiary hearing.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be surprising if a prosecutor's own notes would be considered determinative of a challenge? Wouldn't that be kind of, like if you were someone who really was biased or prejudiced, which I would never imagine that in your office, you might make, you know, notes that cover your tracks, mightn't you?
Well, I suppose if
there's been a Batson challenge, right?
well, let me respond.
Knowing that there might very well be a Batson challenge.
Well, can I say this, Your Honor? Here in response. The voir dire, you'll notice when you read the transcript, some of the questioning of the jurors lasted one page of transcript. One page of transcript. So I think it would be extraordinary for a prosecutor to go into the process and think, I better take notes that are going to reflect that I'm not discriminating on the basis of race, and to do that on the fly. That's not what happened here. It presupposes a Professor Moriarty type.
Of course, I'm sure it didn't happen here, nor is there any reason to believe that this district court judge didn't consider all of the evidence, all of the arguments before him, you know, and I think, you know, that's unsupported speculation.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not accusing the district court of misrepresenting what it did in its opinion. What I'm just saying is that when the defendant argues that the judge says, you know,
I think what you're saying, as far as we know, that the judge didn't consider the Kane County Sheriff's Office or the Army Service or the boiler to be relevant because he thought the government was committed to striking people who didn't have a good education.
That's absolutely right.
If there are any other questions,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Meacham.